Blog Talk Radio.
I love that part, sweeping the streets I used to roam and perhaps own. Welcome, everyone. I'm Greg Masters, your co-host for the show, This Week in Oncology. We're broadcasting today from San Diego, California, on Friday, October the 14th, 2011. And joining me today, as always, is my co-host and partner in this endeavor, Dr. Richard Just. Welcome, Richard.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's great to be here.
I'm glad you could make it. We're excited today. We have an opportunity to chat with Dr. James Sinclair. And let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Sinclair. He was raised in Wisconsin, where he completed his undergraduate and medical school training at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His mentor at Madison, Robert Schilling, MD, suggested he do a post-MD training at UCSD with Dr. Helen Rainey and Dr. Mark Green, who continued to mentor him in the field of hematology and medical oncology. Dr. Sinclair began his private practice in 1987 and spent the last several years fully engaged in the private practice of hematology and medical oncology. Dr. Sinclair has offices in La Jolla and Encinitas. He is the medical director of the Scripps Cancer Center at Scripps Memorial Hospital, La Jolla. His interests include benign hematology, all forms of cancer, as well as palliative medicine that lead to his position as medical director of a local hospice program, which we'll hear more about later. Dr. Sinclair sees himself as the quarterback for his patients as they try to navigate their way through this complex arena of cancer care. Welcome, Dr. Sinclair.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'm glad you could join us. So, Dr. Jess, it's all yours.
Thanks, Greg. Jim, I'm thrilled that you could make it today, and I appreciate your spending the time during your lunch hour. I recognize that you've only had a carrot so far, so that hopefully we'll get you to the chicken soup. Basically, being a partner with you has been a real treat for me, and I've learned everything from palliative care and end-of-life care, quote-unquote, both from you and from the others in the group. And I'd like to start there a little bit because in the ASCO Post in September, there was an article entitled Palliative Care, Quality of Life, and Cost. And the introduction to the interview with a Dr. Diane Meyer, who's the director of the Hertzberg Palliative Care Institute in Mount Sinai School of Medicine, New York, went like this. More than half of our nation's patients with cancer are Medicare beneficiaries, making the entitlement program ground zero in the heated debate on healthcare spending. Total Medicare expenditures attributable to beneficiaries in their last year of life runs upward of 30%. This statistic serves as a rallying point for the charge that too much expensive care is used in advanced cancer. But, according to Dr. Meyer, it's our fragmented delivery system that we should be focusing on, not cutting expenses in treating advanced cancer. So I'd like to just kick this off by getting your take on, you know, where we are in healthcare in general and the recent focus on are we spending too much money in the last year of life.
Right. Well, first off, once again, I appreciate having the time to talk. I think it's a little tricky because, as you know, Dick, a lot of our patients, when they first meet us, may have as little as a year or less of life, and I certainly feel that they deserve top top-notch health care, whatever it takes. And certainly there are occasionally some fairly expensive treatments, whether it's chemotherapy, surgery, radiation, when appropriate. But I do think that palliative care is important, and I think that when I trained, it didn't exist. Even hospice barely existed back in the 80s, and now that it does exist, both of them exist, I think that I would argue that the options for our patients have improved. And it's my opinion that we as oncologists need to introduce the subject or the topic of palliative care immediately at our first visit. I think ASCO, our governing body that you mentioned, has a statement that says that a new cancer patient, whether they have 6 months to live or 6 years to live, or maybe they're even curable, it's important that at that first visit to discuss goals of care and whether or not they have a terminal illness or whether or not they have a disease that they may live for years. There's going to come in the point with each of our patients where they're going to be near the end of life, and it would be nice to know their goals when they're healthy, not when they're desperately ill in the emergency room, short of breath, and they don't know what to do, but rather when they're first there, the first few visits, to get those clear. And I think that Dr. Meyer at Mount Sinai would argue that the earlier we have these discussions, the smoother that transition goes between aggressive curative therapy and palliative care. And interestingly, as you may comment later, if you add palliative care to the management of lung cancer patients, at least, it appears that they actually live a little bit longer than patients without palliative care. So there is this sense amongst my colleagues that when you add palliative care that you're giving up and the patient's going to die soon, where that's not necessarily the case if we bring it earlier in the trajectory of the disease. So I do think we have to be cautious of costs, and I think that palliative care, by aligning the goals of care and allowing the patient to be at home and not in the hospital, not in the ICU, make the decision when it's appropriate to discontinue the expensive treatments, can, as a side effect of having good palliative care, actually save money.
Great. Well, I wholeheartedly agree with you. I think that was very well put, and I'm sure that all of our group is in alignment in this regard.
Absolutely.
You brought up the emergency room issue, and you know, unfortunately, as Dr. Meyer points out in the article, the only alternative we have sometimes, even if we're trying to provide palliative care, is when a crisis arises, is to utilize the emergency room. And it's her feeling that that's because the financial incentives aren't there to provide all of this care in the community at home.
Yeah, she's right on that. Let me give you an example, Dick. This is a hospice patient of ours who came to the emergency room because instead of calling the hospice, the patient called 911. And by the time the patient got out of the emergency department 6 hours later, this patient had probably about $50,000 worth of tests done. Clearly, if this patient were well and had wanted to have an aggressive plan of care, those might have been reasonable. But if, in fact, healthcare could step in that situation, arrive earlier than the patient in the emergency room and address those needs, it's conceivable that you could save a lot of money by either avoiding the ER or perhaps creating a different pattern so that when the patient arrives with a palliative care plan of care, that the hospital changes their approach and doesn't provide a sort of a shotgun approach to doing all the tests known to man, and instead addresses the symptoms, which is what really a goal is with palliative care, so that clearly ER visits are necessary. If I break my leg or if I, you know, get hit by a car, I'd certainly want to get that care in the emergency department. But I think a lot of the care that takes place could be done in a different setting, either at home, in a nursing home, with palliative care outpatient programs, and with hospices.
Right. Bringing up the term hospice has always been a difficult situation when I'm talking with patients. And that basically revolves around the fact of using the term, because right from the beginning, hospice equals end of life. And when actually we're trying to promote palliative care, which is really what our goal is,
right?
And to use the concepts of hospice as they have been so useful at the end of life, but also initiate at least some of them right from the beginning, as you suggested.
Yeah.
So I tend to avoid the use of the term hospice, you know, because it just brings on the false assumption that I'm giving up on the patient.
Right. Well, and I think that you would agree that depending upon the hospices, there are lots of good hospices where we are, and some of our hospices will provide some pretty amazing care for people, fairly aggressive things like blood transfusions and radiation therapy and things like that. I think clearly anybody who's had a loved one have hospice care would argue that it is not, the focus is really not about end of life or dying. The focus of the people in hospice are about quality of life and living the best they can. Yes, the Medicare guidelines require that hospice services to be paid for, that the physician has to predict that the survival is likely to be less than 6 months if the disease follows its normal course. However, we're not that good at predicting. And if you go on hospice and you're alive 6 months later, they don't boot you off of hospice. You're allowed to stay on as long as your prognostic criteria are the same. But you're right. With patients who have been aggressively treating, trying to shrink their cancer so that they can live longer, it's very troublesome to have to sit down with them when they come in with the result of a scan that looks like the cancer is progressing. Now, should I give them fourth-line chemotherapy for their lung cancer, which has significant toxicity and relatively low likelihood of changing their cancer? Or should I offer them hospice or a palliative care option without the toxicity? It's a challenge because they come to me to be healed. They don't come to me for palliative care or for hospice. And so to have that conversation is difficult. But I think if we have the conversation early, and we outline the fact that it's a continuum, we talk about how we want to focus on symptoms and signs at the beginning. We don't just want to focus on the blood test. I can't tell you how many times I go into the exam room to ask a patient how they're doing, and they look up at me with their blood counts in my hand, and they go, "I don't know. You tell me." Well,
right.
the reality is I want to know how they're feeling. Are they tired? Are they weak? Are they in pain? The numbers are interesting, and they're helpful to guide their therapy, but that's really not the symptom I'm trying to manage. So I really think that we probably have become so laboratory and x-ray oriented that we've lost track of the fact that symptoms are still important. And so I try to have that conversation early with my patient, that the blood work and the x-rays are simply a portion of what I pay attention to. I'm just as interested in their quality of life. I'm as interested in their pain management. Are their bowels moving okay? I'm interested in their social life. How is their family situation? Do they lose their job? I'm interested in their spiritual life. Are they okay? Or do they have a spiritual support? Are they suffering in any way, physically, mentally, spiritually? Those are important things at the very beginning, and they need to remain important throughout. And then when the decision comes to decide whether they're going to go to a fourth-line chemotherapy for their lung cancer or possibly consider a palliative approach where they may not get the chemotherapy, they may need some pain medication, maybe they need some oxygen, maybe they're having a hard time getting to the bathroom, maybe they need a bedside commode, things that can improve their quality of life, whatever the quantity is. And to be able to make sense of that conversation without the sense that we're abandoning them, without the sense that we're, quote, giving up, with the reality that life is terminal, and that ultimately we're all going to meet that point. And not that to avoid death, but to be able to get there comfortably so that we're not neglecting all the symptoms that patients go through just to have their treatment.
I also heard the word spirituality. I'd like to just turn the conversation a little bit to that, because I know that you're very involved in spiritual aspects of treatment and so forth.
Yeah. I'd love to share my journey briefly, Dick, if I could.
Sure.
As you know, we are blessed to be at the bedside of patients all day long. Many of them die from their disease. And I thought of it as a failure. They're dying, I failed, what a disaster. And then I realized it's an honor to be with them because they have so much to share during that part of their journey. And then I realized that there is actually spiritual suffering. There's not just physical suffering, there's spiritual suffering. And a lot of our patients look at their cancer maybe as punishment, depending upon their religion, or they may actually feel sort of abandoned by their spiritual support group. Many of them actually feel very supported, but they hate to bring it up. Like, for example, I have patients who are going through treatment and who have an entire family or community praying for them. And they'd like to share that. They feel that's important, but they're a little bit hesitant to bring it up, either because maybe I'm not of the same religion or maybe I don't believe in prayer as a tool for the care of a person with cancer. And so what happened was I went off to a retreat called The Art of Presence in Italy about 3 years ago. And I really...
I remember that.
It was run by a minister, a physician who's head of palliative of the George Washington Institute of Spirituality and Healthcare. Diana Pacholsky, she's an amazing woman. She's an internist at George Washington. And then a musician, Michael Stillwater, who's an amazing musician, and his wife, who's an amazing vocalist. And for a week, we were retreated in Assisi, Italy. And one of the things that we talked about, we were all healthcare providers, nurses, doctors, social workers, chaplains, what have you. And we talked about the fact that couple of things that we could learn. One is to be present when we're in the exam room. Now you could think, well, wait a minute, what are you talking about? Of course we are. Well, being present in the exam room doesn't just mean sitting in a chair, because unfortunately, I don't know about you, but I have a tendency to want to check my email, my cell phone. I'm thinking about the next patient. I'm thinking about, oh no, the wife is going to ask me a difficult question. And I forget that the patient's talking and I need to listen. And so active listening is something that I learned about. It was taught minimally in medical school, unfortunately, I think. So one of the lessons I took home from this particular conference is simply being present. It doesn't mean you have to kneel down and pray with the patient. Certainly, if that's a choice that you want to make, so be it. But to simply be present is an act of reverence, in my opinion, and it shows a spiritual connection. The other thing we learned about was the possibility of taking a spiritual history, finding out the meaning of spirituality in the life of that patient. For many of our patients, they're devout in their religion, and they want to share that fact. And who are their leaders? Is it their pastor? Is it their rabbi? Maybe it's their family. But I found that they want to share this information. And then to ask the question, well, how can we use your spiritual system in the future? How are we going to use that system to work together, whether it's with your church, whether it's with your meditation group or whatever it is? How can we work together to meet all of your needs? And I've done some lectures basically called Spirituality in Healthcare and Medicine. And I've given this lecture at hospice. I've given the lecture to a breast cancer support group. I gave the lecture at our last Survivor Day at Scripps La Jolla, and a week from Tuesday, I'm going to give this lecture for Grand Rounds at the hospital. And what I've found is basically what this shares is it shares scientific data that shows that spirituality matters, makes a difference, and patients want to have this subject talked about with their doctor. They're not asking their doctor to be of the same religion. They're not asking their doctor for religious advice. They're simply wanting to share the importance of it in their life. And if necessary, for the physician to perhaps be able to point them in the direction of resources. Our hospital has good spiritual counseling. We certainly have clinical pastoral help. To me, hospice is a great example of this. Hospice does tremendous spiritual work, and I think that, in fact, the head of our clinical pastoral education at the hospice I work at, John Gilman, is the one who suggested I explore this area, because he thinks it's not just the chaplain's job to provide these resources. They're the expert. So if I have a patient who's having significant spiritual suffering, I should try to locate a chaplain either at the hospital or in their church or wherever in the community who they can access and do some significant counseling. So what I found is when I bring it up, my patients are interested. If I don't bring it up, they're embarrassed, they're cautious, they're concerned, and they suffer. Anytime you can't have a connection, you suffer.
Right. Right. Well, very well said. I know there were a couple of things that occurred to me while you were talking. One, the being present. What flashed through my mind was a patient that I saw many, many years ago who said to me when I walked into the room and closed the door, he said, "You know, there are two things that I've always liked about you." So I said, "Well, what's that?" You know. He says, "Number one, when you're in the room, I get the feeling that you're only thinking about me and my issues." So I said, "Well, thank you. You know, I appreciate that." And I said, "What's number two?" He says, "Number two is when plan A doesn't work, you always seem to have plan B." So,
yeah, I think you're, and you know, that's good, because in some ways that's true, because if you think about it, if plan A doesn't work, aggressive curative treatment, I don't look at hospice as giving up or palliative care as giving up.
Right.
I like to look at those as plan B. It may be second-line chemotherapy, right, or it may be radiation therapy. But a lot of physicians, I think, get nervous when their book treatment that they provided the patient, quote, fails, and the book doesn't have anything to follow through with. I think we always have our presence to follow through with. So if I have a patient who's clearly dying, just by being present, just by having them come in, I may not give them any medicines, I may not do any blood work, we may simply talk. And as far as I'm concerned, that can be as therapeutic as morphine or chemotherapy. And I think I think that physicians feel that they are capable of doing it. You know, not all are as comfortable with it as others. I think a lot of us feel, well, gee, maybe that's not going to be paid for, or maybe I don't have time for it. Well, interestingly, Dick, when I came back from Assisi and I made this point that I was going to try with each patient at each visit to have a moment of presence, initially I thought, well, it's going to slow my day down because I have so much to take care of during that 15 to 30 minute visit. Well, it turns out it hasn't changed how long it takes to be with the patient, because you can accomplish a lot just during that time of silence that takes the place of some bantering that might take place or questions that might come up, which maybe really are not relevant to where the patient sits. So for me, it hasn't changed. Even taking a spiritual history, here we go again. When I present the grand rounds, I suspect one of the complaints I'm going to get is, well, my gosh, you know, we've got to take a social history, and we need to take all, you know, alcohol, tobacco, and we need to know about all the medications they're taking, and how can I possibly add a spiritual history? Well, the spiritual history only has a few questions to it, and it's something you can do on occasion. But I find that the more often it comes up, the more the patient feels connected. And when they walk out of the room, they may not walk out of the room thinking, oh, I know I'm going to be cured, but they know they're going to be cared for. And to me, it's a transition from high tech, and I love technology. I love the CyberKnife, and I think chemotherapy, some of the new targeted chemotherapies, are amazing. But I think at the same time, we need to provide high touch. And high touch is where we take the time to listen, maybe give them a hug, whatever it takes to make them feel that they're being supported. My sense is the feedback is almost uniformly positive. And there's tons of data to show that when a patient feels supported, when a patient has their stress level managed, that their outcome, their symptoms are better controlled. Even their disease outcome is improved. And in fact, it brings me to something I talk about with all of my patients. Everybody I see, I tell them three things at the end of my consultation. One, I want to make sure that they take care of their nutrition, that they pay attention to the nutrition. I don't get into details because there's a lot of debate about that, but there are some good, healthy nutritional programs out there that they need to pay attention. Two, I want them to be physically active. Even if you're in a wheelchair, you can do exercises. And I expect that they can do those things. And lastly, manage their stress. And that includes their spirituality. And there's data that supports all three of those things, strengthen the immune system and improving outcomes, both survival and quality of life. And that's not a pill. That's not me doing something to them. That's them doing something for them. I mean, who better to offer help than yourself? And I think that that's where Western medicine probably struggles a little bit. I think there's a lot of people out there who just assume there's a pill for everything or there's an operation for everything. And after 25 years of practicing, it's clear that's not true. So I think we have to show some degree of responsibility, and that includes my patients. Yeah, I know they're stressed, and yes, I know they can't do everything. But I think by being responsible, you feel better about yourself. You feel that you've participated. And when my women finish their adjuvant therapy for breast cancer and they say, oh, my God, what am I going to do? Who's going to treat my cancer anymore? I go, you're going to help. You're going to eat sensibly, you're going to exercise, and you're going to manage your stress. And by doing that, you're going to contribute to the reduction in the incidence of breast cancer recurrence.
Right. Well, I'm thrilled that you brought up this whole topic, and the way you phrased it is outstanding. I find also that, you know, patients are looking for ways that they can help themselves.
Right.
And the very issues that you brought up are really the most pertinent things. In fact, yesterday I saw a patient who said to me, what do you think about that recent article about vitamins being risky for your health?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, where did you read that article? And then today I saw it quoted, online, and I think it was from Medscape or something like that.
No, I'm glad that they're paying attention, and I'm glad that we're providing them balanced information about diet. I think one of the reasons why I didn't delve into diet is that, as you know, there's so many controversies. Should we be vegetarian? Should we use high doses of vitamins? Should we be doing tons of – and I think the reality is that you have to be careful before you jump in into any dietary program. And in fact, here at Scripps La Jolla, we raise enough money so that if a person is interested, our nutritionist, our dietitian who has oncology training, will meet with them for at least one session and talk about some of the information that's available, that's some common sense information, as well as some information that might be more myth or lore, and try to straighten some of those things out so the patients understand. Because, I mean, it's an industry. I mean, you go into Henry's, or I guess it's Sprouts now, there's more vitamins than there is food in that place. I still think food rules when it comes to nutrition over vitamins.
Absolutely. I really appreciate your spending the time, Jim. It's been really a joy listening to you again. And you are basically a holistic doctor, and it's a pleasure to get your viewpoints. I really appreciate it. Go ahead.
I want to thank the listeners, too. I hope they get something from it, and You know, for me, I think the more patients pay attention, the more they're involved, I think the better their care is going to be.
Thanks again, Jim.
Well,
all right,
thanks, everyone. Join us next week, This Week in Oncology. Bye now.